This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Welcome to a special Press Play on KCRW, California's Clout in 2020. We're in Long Beach at the Democratic Party convention in front of a live audience. Today, we'll explore California's role in the 2020 Democratic primary and how the state's primary on March 3rd gives California more clout than ever before in picking the party's nominee. Joining us today is Josh Barrow, business columnist at New York Magazine and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center.
Hi, Madeline.
Nominee Const, a former Bernie Sanders surrogate. She's board director at Matriarch. That's a new PAC aiming to increase the number of progressive working women in office.
Hello, Madeline.
And Gustavo Arellano is here, features writer for Los Angeles Times and a frequent contributor to KCRW.
Hola, Madeline.
Okay, it's great to have you all here. I want to just begin with a general question which goes at the conceit of this entire show, and that is the importance of California, California's clout. So the primary is March 3rd. There are 416 delegates at stake. And I guess the question is, will it work? Will California now have more say this election than it has in previous elections? Let's begin with Josh.
Well, I think it depends a lot on what happens in the first four states to vote, because, I mean, the process that we have leading up to Super Tuesday with California and so many other states voting at the beginning of March, obviously we'll go through Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. And so you can imagine a scenario where one candidate has won all or most of those states and then rolls in with momentum. And while the campaign will not be decided before Super Tuesday, it's likely that those early state wins will give a person a lot of momentum. The only Democratic nominee who has won the nomination in recent history without winning either Iowa or New Hampshire was Bill Clinton in 1992. And that's sort of an example that doesn't even really count, because Senator Tom Harkin ran for president in 1992, so nobody really contested the Iowa caucuses that year. So in general, you know, there's a lot of power in winning Iowa or New Hampshire, especially winning both of them. Now, there are two flip sides to that. One is that we have such a fragmented field this time. And the other is there's this growing disconnect in the Democratic Party where something like 40% of the electorate will be non-white, but Iowa and New Hampshire are so very white. And so at some point there has to be a bit of a breakdown between two principles, which are that Iowa and New Hampshire decide who's going to be the nominee and that non-white voters have enormous influence in determining who's going to be the nominee. So this would be a better year than normal for there to be someone to come from behind without winning Iowa and New Hampshire. But I still think, you know, if we're looking very fragmented coming out of those states, then California's going to be very important, but it's possible it'll be wrapped up before we get here.
What do you think, Gustavo?
I think California has, for the past, since 2016, really set itself as the home of the resistance. Iowa and New Hampshire are not the resistance. California is. So I could definitely see you might have other states going with other candidates, but with California, I don't know if, say, if it's a Biden or a Buttigieg who wins these earlier seats, that California voters would necessarily go for them. They're still probably going to go with their Bernie or, or Warren, probably not Kamala at this point, but I think they're still to hold on to those progressive values.
Well, there is another wrinkle to that, and that is California voters like to mail in their ballots. And the mail-in ballots will be sent out on the very same day as the Iowa caucuses, on February 3rd.
A whole month before.
So it's conceivable that they'll see what happens in Iowa. Maybe they see what happens in New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, and they vote before the primary.
Yeah, if one person collects the first three states, as Josh mentioned, yes, it could influence California through the early mail-ins or even on the day of the primary. With that being said, I personally think that California will be very important this election, but not for the reasons that many thought initially. California, it was a little controversial when they moved up their primary. Initially, you know, it was in June last time around, and now it's in March. California is a very expensive state. It has very expensive media markets, and traditionally candidates that have more money do better in expensive states with expensive media markets. This time around, though, the candidates with the most money happen to be Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and they have collected that money through small dollar contributions, without corporate money, without Southern California big dollar fundraisers and Hamptons fundraisers. So I don't know if that was by design by the California Democratic Party to move it up, but that was one of the concerns that people had. So if, for instance, Senator Sanders picks up, you know, one state, New Hampshire, this is an exercise, and and Senator Warren picks up, you know, Nevada, and Kamala Harris picks up South Carolina, and of course, you know, Biden picks up, or Buttigieg picks up Iowa. You could have a very interesting scenario with California splitting because it's not a winner-take-all state. And so on Super Tuesday, we could have a four-way race, or we could have a one-way race. It's really hard to tell.
I'm going to be interested to see about those mail-in ballots because, I mean, in a general election, most voters are partisans. Even most people who call themselves independents vote always or almost always for one party. So you can look at your ballot 5 weeks ahead of the general election, know what your preferences are going to be on election day, and send that ballot in early. But when you look at polling in this primary, the numbers of voters who say they have a candidate preference but that they might vote for someone else are enormous. You'll see things like in some primary poll, you'll see that Elizabeth Warren has this percentage, but literally 70% of those respondents say it's possible that they will vote for somebody else. So I suspect you'll have some voters who are very attached to one candidate and they'll be happy to send that ballot in early. But I kind of expect that you'll see a lot of people holding onto those ballots longer than they normally would in California because they're waiting to make up their mind and maybe because they are waiting to see the results from some of the earlier states.
Are they waiting for more candidates to jump in?
No. We have enough already. Too many.
I think the consultants are waiting. They're like, oh, another paycheck? Sure.
Voters are more satisfied with this candidate field than in previous campaigns. When you look in the polls, the discontent with this field, it's not there among the voters. It is there among certain elements of the donor class and the consultant class. And I don't think it's purely about not wanting a candidate who's so far to the left, although I think that's part of it. But I mean, you know, there is the big moderate candidate in the field who's Joe Biden, who has been in the lead on the national polls the entire time. There were a few polls over the last 6 weeks or so that had Warren in the lead, but still we're seeing Biden in the lead in almost all the national polls. And so you would think if you are a worried member of the Democratic establishment who wants someone more centrist with demonstrated appeal in general election polling, that you'd go with Joe Biden. Everyone seems convinced that he's just, you know, one step away from falling apart, but they've been convinced of that for months, and his poll lead in the national polls is persistent.
Well, and just on that note, you know, these early states are about enthusiasm, especially states like New Hampshire, which is an open primary. You have independents and Republicans who can vote in that primary. And in Iowa, it is about enthusiasm. It's who can excite their base enough. And he, at this point in the last filings, which we'll talk about later, has $9 million in the bank right now. This is Biden, the centrist, the corporate Democrat. They had to set up a super PAC so that his big donors who maxed out could help out on the side. And I think that's where Pete Buttigieg sees an opportunity. And we've seen him move more to the center and pick
up
that.
He is now polling number one in Iowa.
And then the latest, you know, just to show how crazy these polls are right now, the latest national poll, Bernie Sanders came in the lead. So it is extremely close, and we are still 2 months away, more than 2 months away, from Iowa.
So what does Deval Patrick do in this race? What does he do to
Nothing.
This race? Michael Bloomberg.
Nothing. At this point, there's no enthusiasm for these people. It's Johnny come latelys. And I think there's a lot of enthusiasm about this, but I think the key thing for the Democrats at this point, all these candidates who have all their fan bases, tell everyone, if I don't win, you fall in line with whoever's going to win. This is what we need. And I hope that happens, at least for, you know, for the sake of the Democrats.
You know, my theory on Patrick, and this might be like, I mean, this is how we have to exercise at this point. It's like conspiracy land because we don't know. I think that there are certain donors in the Democratic Party and supporters of the Democratic Party who want to have as many securities in place in case of a Warren or a Bernie coming along. And if it does become a contested convention, it becomes, what happens is you have several candidates, and if one is not chosen on the first ballot of the convention, you move to the second ballot. And in the second ballot, suddenly all bets are off. It becomes, you know, the superdelegates come back, which we eliminated after 2016. They come in and they get to choose whoever they want. And if Biden does not have enough money to go past South Carolina, and if Pete Buttigieg is not a strong enough candidate because he's a mayor of a medium-sized, you know, city in America, maybe some people don't think he's strong enough to take it to the White House, then Barack Obama has openly said that he would like to see a Deval Patrick as president.
Speaking of Barack Obama, he said yesterday, the average American doesn't think we have to completely tear down the system and remake it. He was basically talking to a room full of pretty wealthy Democratic donors and basically saying, look, don't get too excited about Warren and Sanders because that's not where the American electorate is.
Well, I think there's evidence for this. Alan Abramowitz, who's a political scientist at Emory, looked at competitive congressional races. About half the Democrats who ran for Congress in the 2018 cycle endorsed single-payer health care. He found that on average that cost them 4.5 points in the margin in their races. Now, it was a very good year for Democrats. So obviously you saw a lot of Democrats who were for single-payer win, sometimes even in competitive districts like Katie Porter. But in general, yes, there was a penalty associated with that. The polling on it depends a lot on what you tell people about how the system will work. They don't like it when you tell them that it's going to take away private insurance. They don't like it when you tell them that it involves new taxes. Those are things you end up having to discuss as you get farther into the campaign. So I think there's that to worry about. And then there's also some more cultural issues. Nate Cohn has done some very interesting polling on this at the New York Times, looking at these persuadable voters, people who tell pollsters that they would vote for some Democratic candidates over Trump, but not others. And it seems to be a mix of more affluent voters who have a problem with single payer and socialism and those sorts of things, and non-college educated voters, including a substantial number of non-white men who seem to have more cultural concerns about the Democratic Party and who are more favorable toward Donald Trump than you might expect.
But their second choice is Bernie Sanders, which is actually pretty astounding. So I think, you know, these theories are yet to be exercised. And, you know, the same statement, Barack Obama also said that the Democrats need to be focusing on winning. And, you know, I'm on the left, so I can say this openly. Barack Obama was the head of the Democratic Party during the tenure that the Democrats lost 1,200 seats. So something I think for a lot of Democrats across the country needs to change. And, you know, there's the Democratic primary, and there are different demographics in different districts. I mean, if you look at millennials in California, the Latino population, and compare that to, you know, the upper white middle class in Orange County, California, those are two different Democratic parties that are in opposition with each other. So demographics are going to play a lot into the future of the Democratic Party, especially as millennials become the major voting bloc.
You have perfectly teed us up for our next segment, which we're going to talk about that a lot more in the next segment. We're going to talk about issues that are important to young voters, issues that are important to Latinx voters. We're going to talk about this suburban-urban divide, whether or not the districts that went blue this last midterm election will be able to stay blue. All of that is coming up when our special broadcast from the California Democratic Party convention continues, coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and welcome back to a special Press Play on KCRW, California's Clout in 2020. We're at the Edison Theater in Long Beach as the California Democratic Party convention is underway. I'm here with Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center, Nomaki Konst, who is a board director at Matriarch PAC, and Gustavo Arellano, features writer at the LA Times, formerly of the OC Weekly. Welcome back, you guys. Okay, a presidential town hall forum hosted by Univision wrapped up a few hours ago here in Long Beach. And I guess the overall question that this brings up is, how important is it for the presidential candidates to court Latinx voters in California? Gustavo.
We are the future. We're not the future. We're the present. Latinos are now a plurality, have been a plurality of the population in California. The Democratic Party in California is now ostensibly the party that was radicalized by Pete Wilson and Proposition 187, the 1994 initiative that sought to penalize undocumented immigrants and turn the state to the far left tilt that it is today. So I think this is what makes California so important and overall for the future of the Democratic Party. As California goes for the Democrats, so it is going to be for the rest of the United States. And you do have young, not even just young Latino voters, even myself, Gen X voters in their 40s who are never going to vote for the Republican Party again. And they want more liberal activism from your Democrats. You don't want the moderates, especially when it comes to the issue of immigration. So we're very important.
The latest polling that I saw shows that about 25% of likely Democratic voters are Latinx. Mm. So, but the question I have is, do they actually vote? Because we saw some issues with that with Kevin De Leon's candidacy, with Antonio Villaraigosa's candidacy. Both of those candidates really relied on a Latino voting base that didn't turn out as heavily as an older white voting demographic turns
when
out.
Is a sleeping giant going to flex its political muscle? That's all Democrats ever want to know. And look, at the end, the Latinos are going to vote for issues or candidates they really feel enthusiastic about. And nothing against Kevin De Leon, who was really good. there was nothing enthusiastic for Latinos to come out. On the other hand, especially in California, Latinos are legendary, I would argue, for being reactive voters. So if you're going to demonize them, they're going to come out and they're going to vote you out of office. And if you want an example of that, come to my beautiful Orange County, where it's all blue and all those Latinos did come out to go against those Republicans during the 2018 election.
Okay. All right, then.
Well, it's funny because Democrats are always, they know that the Latinos are the future of the Democratic Party, and then they wonder, why don't you vote for us more often? Well, maybe if you had some candidates that were exciting for once,
well,
then they would vote
more.
Well, are there some now? Now there are. Theo Bernie. A lot of Latinos are going for Bernie Sanders. Kamala Harris is not exciting because of her record on, you know, on the criminal justice system in California, and especially in Orange County, siding with a former Orange County district attorney on the snitch scandal. And, you know, and you're not necessarily going to vote for Latino candidates. And it's either Julian Castro, you know, you think, oh, all the Latinos are going to vote for him. Well, he's not really known in California, so he's not really gaining much traction.
Well, and you can say the same with African-American voters. They are going for Joe Biden. They're not going for Cory Booker.
Right. Overwhelmingly. So close to half of the black vote for Joe Biden, especially older black voters. I mean, I think in all of these demographic groups, you see a huge generational divide where you see very, very strong support for Joe Biden among older black voters. It's a much more fragmented field for the young black vote. And you see sort of similar divisions among white voters and Hispanic voters also. I think one interesting thing when you ask about Hispanic turnout, which has historically lagged both black and white turnout, those New York Times surveys have interesting things to say about non-voters, because I think people sort of project onto non-voters, like, these are people who are like me and feel like me but don't vote. And that's generally not true. In particular, non-voters tend to be much less ideological, which is probably a reason they don't vote. They don't have strong and coherent political views. The big exceptions to this seems to be the Hispanic vote, where the non-voting Hispanic population is as far or farther to the left than the voting Hispanic population. And so that is the opportunity for Democrats, but it's been the opportunity for Democrats for a long time. And to Gustavo's point, it's not clear, you know, I mean, obviously you need to excite people, but they haven't found the formula to close that gap yet.
But you're saying they did with Theo Bernie.
He's gaining excitement, especially amongst the millennials that I know. They're burners, or whatever you want to call them, whatever they call themselves or whatnot.
Burners.
But like, yeah, burners. But not the Joe Bidens, not the Kamalas. And then the other voter, the other candidates like Buttigieg and whatnot, they still, at least in Southern California, they still don't know enough about
them. Well, some of that has to do with Prop 187. They're the children of the families that were restricted health care and education, and Bernie's, you know, top two issues for millennials is education and healthcare. And so I think that there's been some sort of connecting agent there. And you know, he's been running for the last 6 years, and he's invested, you know, heavily in, you know, fighting for DACA recipients. I mean, much of his support staff in California and in Nevada are DACA recipients.
Yeah.
But given that, given the infrastructure that he's built, I just find it surprising how weak his polling numbers have been nationally and across many demographic groups in this campaign.
I mean,
he took north of 40% of the vote nationally 4 years ago. He's polling it generally at less than half of that.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, you know, the question is, you know, why did people vote for Sanders in 2016? Obviously, it was a combination of people who are committed socialists and had a devotion to his agenda, people who wanted to shake up the system and wanted an outsider, which could mean a lot of different things ideologically, and people who didn't like Hillary Clinton. And so I think we're learning something about what the composition was of those three groups. Obviously, he's bleeding some voters on the left to Elizabeth Warren, who's made a somewhat similar pitch, but he hasn't been able to rebuild that coalition.
But when you look at the numbers, a recent PPIC poll here in California found that 39% of Latinx voters preferred Bernie, 21% Biden, 5% for Warren. 5% for Warren, even though she's also promising free college and Medicare for all.
Again, Bernie's been running for 6 years. Warren, even though she's not new to the political stage, definitely she's new in the presidential election. I think, and I just think Bernie just gets much more enthusiasm out of instead of Warren, but that might change.
And that's the factor that we didn't recognize in 2016. You know, yes, he did get those numbers, but exactly where we are today, 2016, people were underestimating him, and then he surprised people in the polls in Iowa where there were coin flips, and in New Hampshire, of course, he took a win, and Michigan, you know, he did very well, and in California, if the race hadn't been called, some would say that he would have probably done a little bit better, but if you recall, the day before the primary, the election was called for Hillary. So, you know, he has a very enthusiastic base that I don't think even Warren has to that level. And sometimes that doesn't play into the polls. I mean, he has a high millennial base, and polls tend to skew older. Landlines, I mean, there are some polls that don't use landlines, but let's be real. That's what's being cited in the press. And it has there's a factor in psychology there.
Broadly, a lot of the state level polling has just not been very good. And this has been a problem going back through 2016. I mean, another big issue in addition to who will pick up their phone these days is just the polls to who will talk to a pollster. You tend to get way too many people who either have college educations or at least tell the pollster that they have college educations in these polls. And so this is a big issue in general election polling in places like Michigan and Wisconsin, where some of these pollsters will, you know, report a big result for Democrats. And you look at the poll and it says that Michigan is as well educated as Massachusetts, which is not true. And so that's been a problem in the primary polling as well. That could be a point of weakness for Bernie because his voting base skews less educated than Elizabeth Warren's, who really over-indexes with college-educated voters. But a lot of pollsters have been having a lot of trouble accurately representing the electorate in these state polls. That's a part of a reason that you see results that look so different across different pollsters, including in California, that paint an unclear picture. People are really having trouble figuring out, you know, how to get an accurate sample of the electorate.
And are they also having trouble figuring out what the electorate wants? When you poll people on their top issues, what they say versus what they really want, are campaigns finding it difficult to skew their message to these polls?
I would say yes. I mean, every pollster is different in their methods. And some of the issues, it might just be like, are you more conservative? Well, what does conservative look like today as a Democrat? Are you more progressive? What does that look like today as a Democrat? Is it economics or is it social? So all these issues are a little bit conflicting in today's polling, and we might have some big surprises in some of these early states as a result.
Let's talk about Orange County, because there was a bit of a political revolution in Orange County last year in the midterm election. And so, Gustavo, do you think that Orange County will continue to trend bluer?
What's interesting about the 2018 congressional elections was that a lot of it had to deal with the candidates that were running. There was no enthusiasm whatsoever with the Republicans who lost. I mean, they were all a bunch of losers, all of them. Dana Rohrabacher, loser. Mimi Walter, loser. Diane Harkey, who was running down there. No one likes, I mean, and I'm talking as a lifelong Orange County resident who also tracked Orange County stuff for years. And so, you were running against Trump. You're running with very, you know, pathetic candidates on the Republican side. Now in 2018, though, and the Republicans, they thought they were going to have a catwalk. Now, nope, they are going to come with their guns a-blazing. But here's the thing. The candidates that the Democrats have had for Congress, they're actually pretty good. Katie Porter, a rock star. I guarantee she's going to win easily. The Republicans don't even have anyone against her. The two competitive races are going to be the one that's held now by Harley Ruda, because Michelle Steele, who's a longtime Orange County supervisor and the wife of former GOP, California GOP chair Sean Steele, she's running against him. And then Gil Cisneros, he barely won against Young Kim, who has been a Korean-American woman who has been a politician up there for years. So those are going to be the really competitive ones. And really, the competitive one's going to be Gil Cisneros. But everything else, Orange County is still going to be majority blue. But one other thing. All of the American media just went obsessed. Oh, Orange County's blue. Okay, maybe on the congressional level, but 75% of the local seats are still run by Republicans. So that said, the Democrats now have the head of the Democratic Party in Orange County is Ada Briceño, who comes from Unite Here. I mean, she's a like longtime labor activist. She's a type of Democratic Party chair who goes protest for hotel workers at Disneyland and then gets arrested. I don't see Tom Perez doing any of that. At least not yet.
We had Gustavo on a live episode of Left, Right, and Center last September, and Gustavo said that he thought Democrats were only going to pick up one of those four seats in Orange County.
What do I know?
And then they went 4-for-4. I mean, and so I think, and you know, it's been a surprising thing, right, how rapid the shift was in Orange County. But what we've seen in elections this year in places like Virginia, in the Kentucky governor's race, is that these suburban areas, especially affluent suburban areas, just keep getting worse for Republicans. So I think that's a reason to think the blue-Orange County trend will continue.
But aren't a lot of people saying that they're also a cautionary tale for the Democratic Party, because these areas are not super left-wing, super progressive,
right?
Well,
you think that, but Katie Porter ran as a moderate, and now she's extremely progressive in the progressive wing, and she's going to be uncontested.
Yeah, that's an anomaly, though, because that's around UCI, so there's always been a lot of liberal voters. Like, they would always vote Republican on state Senate and state assembly, but the city council in Irvine and around that was always Democrats, a lot of hard left as well. But Katie is a great example of someone who does exemplify the modern-day suburban Democratic voter. She's a single mom. She's, you know, educated, teaches at UCI. PCI law. And of course, again, she's been a viral star. Just she's walked the walk. Like in her district, she is beloved in a way that I have not seen any congressperson there liked at all. Because remember, the Republicans that voted, people just voted for the Republicans. It was a bunch of kooks, Bob Dornan, Dana Rohrabacher, Bill Danmeyer. No one actually liked them. They just hated Democrats. Now, at least with Katie, there's someone that someone actually likes for once. Also, Mike Levin down in South Orange County, people like him a lot. But Katie's, you know, Katie, if the Democrats on the national scale were smart, they would really listen to a lot of what Katie has to say.
And what about Harley Ruda and Gil Cisneros, however? They're very much in the center of the Democratic Party.
And they have to be, especially with Harley. He's in Huntington Beach, coastal Orange County, so those are going to be more conservative voters. But especially along like Seal Beach, Huntington Beach, there was just a lot, like with Dana Rohrabacher, people were just tired of him. I mean, this guy was Putin's favorite congressperson, just stupidity after stupidity with this guy. So that's what I'm saying with Michelle Steele, like that's going to be a competitive one. And the Republicans, they, trust me, the Republicans in Orange County, this was the land where all the good Republicans go to die per Ronald Reagan. And now it's all blue. They are angry, and they're gonna come. It's gonna be like a Quentin Tarantino movie in 2020.
All right, that's a great way to end the segment. Coming up, we're gonna talk about money in California. Who's getting the money? Where they're getting the money from? All of that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Welcome back to a special Press Play on KCRW, California's Clout in 2020. We are in Long Beach in front of a live audience with Josh Barrow, Gustavo Arellano, Nomaki Konst, and we are going to bring in Ben Christopher now. He is political reporter for CalMatters, where he's written about candidate fundraising in California. Welcome to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you.
Thank you.
Okay, Ben, you have really done a deep dive into the finances.
I have.
You have mapped every single zip code.
I have.
As to who is giving to whom.
Yeah.
And what are the big takeaways?
So it reveals the ideological diversity of California, and it's in many colors. So if you were to make this zip code map, which I did, of itemized contributions in California, which means these are sort of the big money contributions, people who have given over $200 to a presidential candidate. Well, first off, it's a map of where rich people are in California.
Yeah.
So the zip code, the top zip codes in terms of overall contributions, they are 90210, they're Brentwood, they're the Silicon Valley. It's not too surprising there. But if you were to look at sort of which candidates win those zip codes in terms of which candidates get the most from each zip code. It's a diverse state, I guess you could say. Candidates like Senator Harris or Pete Buttigieg, they do really well in San Francisco or downtown Los Angeles. Whereas if you start going outward into inland, President Trump starts doing really well. Bernie Sanders does really well. So there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah. Donald Trump's top zip code is in Rancho Santa Fe, right?
That's true, yeah. So that's just north of San Diego. But actually, Donald Trump does quite well across the state, both in terms of the aggregate numbers. If you were to look at who's raised the most in California from these large donors, across 2019, he has raised more than everyone but Kamala Harris. So, it's surprising on the one hand because, hey, this is California. It's supposed to be blue. On the other hand, there are, 17 Democrats running? 16? I can't actually keep track.
It keeps changing every day.
So, that slice of the pie is being divided up lots of different ways, whereas Trump is getting most of the funding on the Republican side.
And who's getting funding from the small donors?
So, we don't have that broken down at the state level because they're not itemized. But if you look at national numbers, candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are doing quite well with small dollar donors.
How is Pete Buttigieg doing?
So he's doing actually quite well. He had, there was the Buttigieg bump earlier in the year, and that kind of coincided with a spike in contributions to him, and we saw that pick up again in the third quarter. He's done quite well in West Hollywood, in Palm Springs, in certain parts of San Francisco, and so there's certainly, there is clearly appeal among donors in the LGBT community, I think that's fair to say, and he's done quite well in Silicon Valley as well.
And is there a split between people who are getting more money and who is more appealing, polling-wise?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I don't want to say they're inversely related, but there's definitely a disconnect there in California. Again, just looking at the, these are large donors, so if you'd like, you could call them the donor class, maybe. And in terms of who's doing really well in California, it's Kamala Harris, it's Pete Buttigieg, it's Joe Biden. And these are not the names that, well, perhaps Buttigieg sort of excluded. These are not the names that are the top of the polls in California, where Elizabeth Warren is doing quite well here in most recent polls.
I'm wondering what, listening to this, what do you take away from this, Josh, in terms of how the candidates should be campaigning in California? They obviously come here. This used to be just a cash register, but now it's something else. How do they need to campaign to, if, on the cash register side, but also on the side of getting voters?
Well, I think to a significant extent they're separate. And as I note on Left, Right, and Center, when we talk about this fundraise stuff, my husband is a fundraising operative. The Buttigieg for President campaign is a client of his. But I think, you know, one thing that's been interesting with Warren is that she made this decision early on that she is not doing the normal high-dollar fundraising operation that you see. She's not going and pressing the flesh at fundraisers with donors. You're welcome to write her a check for $2,800 if you want, but that's not going to get you a photo with her. It's not going to get you a meeting. It's not going to get you into a small room. And she's been able to do that because of that, of the success that she has had with small donors, to a significant extent replicating the success that Bernie Sanders has had. And I think that that's been an advantage for her in that it gives her more time to campaign. People talk a lot about fundraising and the way that it shapes incentives for candidates and that sort of thing, and that's obviously important. But it is also an enormous time suck. And so I think that, you know, one of the many problems with the Kamala Harris campaign has been, you know, she raised a lot of money, at least initially, but she was also spending a lot of time raising all of that money, and clearly did not have an effective time, you know, convincing voters that they ought to vote for her. So I think that, you know, if you are able to build a campaign model around not doing that fundraising, that can be a big time advantage. I mean, I think also Warren was in a position where she probably wasn't going to do as well with some of those high dollar fundraisers anyway, so her opportunity cost was not as high. But I think that's been an interesting strategic choice that they've made here, and it means that, you know, to the extent that Elizabeth Warren comes to California, it means she's coming to California to campaign.
So what do you think, Gustavo? What does this say to candidates and how they should be campaigning in California? If they do need to raise money, what do they need to do?
They do need to raise money, obviously. And at least in California, it is a bifurcated state. So, yeah, you know where to get the money. The Hollywood executives, Silicon Valley, maybe some of the old money in like San Francisco and Orange County or whatnot. But as you see with Bernie, as you see with Warren, you also have to just travel the state and you have to see all these different constituents that are going to be enthusiastic about you. Again, I cannot overemphasize at least what the Democratic Party is in California. It is progressive to the hilt. This is the sanctuary state now. This is a state where Javier Becerra, the attorney general, and Gavin Newsom revel in not just suing the Trump administration, but openly mocking them. So you're going to end up, and the voters of California, the Democrats, for the most part, like them because they're the ones who are getting elected. I mean, for crying out loud, the Latino Legislative Caucus, they released a video on the 25th anniversary of Prop 187, quote unquote, thanking Pete Wilson. It was like the biggest trolling that I've seen by a supposedly polite Democratic Party in a long, long time. And it's really cool. They put it out online. It was Lorena Gonzalez from San Diego, the assemblywoman there. So I think that's what the candidates need to do. They need to connect with those voters. Like, the money's important, yeah, but if you actually talk to the rabble, like, they're the rabble couldn't vote, and they want to vote in this coming election.
That actually, when you think of Sanders and Warren being overly, I don't know if the word is avaricious, but campaigning for dollars goes against the central tenet of their campaigns, right?
Of course.
The central platform of, you know, being against the millionaires and billionaires.
And you know, one thing that we're keeping out of this conversation, there's still super PACs. And there are still, the Democratic Party, I mean, is still reliant on large donors. I mean, the DNC still has fundraisers in Southern California all the time. And part of the reason why Donald Trump, just looking at these numbers, Donald Trump, from July through September, raised $11 million in California, and the next highest was Kamala Harris at $2.8 million. You know, Donald Trump has whatever super PACs he's going to put together and the RNC. And, you know, the Democrats, I think, are struggling with this because of the identity of the party. The DNC is still relying on the big dollars, but whoever is the next president, you know, they're going to dictate what the Democratic Party's fundraising numbers look like and sound like, and that dictates the policy of the Democratic Party. So a lot of this battle is really over big donors versus, you know, the union members and the union leaders who are running the DNC. And that actually comes down to the DNC membership as well, because you do have a membership that's split between lobbyists and big donors and the activists and the organizers and the union members.
But then you have a billionaire like Tom Steyer, for example.
Right. He's burned 95% burn rate, $49.5 million spent on the race, and 98% of it was his money.
I believe he spent more on ads than everybody else combined
yeah.
in the race. And it's gotten him to like 3% in some
early
states.
He's on the debate stage, though.
He's in Nevada. Yeah. He's doing well.
But he's like a potted plant on the debate stage. It's amazing how little effect he has had for all of this money that he's spent. I mean, I think it's interesting that Mike Bloomberg announced that, you know, as he, you know, even as he isn't yet really running and may not ever run, he's doing a big anti-Trump ad buy, which, you know, at least, you know, that's useful to the Democratic Party, maybe, even if he doesn't run. So that seems a lot better than what Tom Steyer has been doing.
But did you think, going back to your earlier question of whether moving the primary had the intended effect of transforming California just from this ATM machine at the cash register to a place where the voters here actually matter to candidates? And I think the fact that you see someone like Bernie Sanders, for example, was just passed on his way down to Long Beach. He stopped in Fresno. They just opened an office in Fresno. In Fresno, like, presidential candidates don't go to Fresno, but the fact that they're actually making an appeal not just to the money of the state, but actually to the voters, I think that does say something.
All right. We are going to end our segment there. Coming up, the elephant in the room, impeachment. We're going to ask our panelists what they think about the Democrats' strategy so far. That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We are at the Democratic Party State Convention in Long Beach at the Edison Theater with Josh Barrow, business columnist at New York Magazine and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Nomaki Konst, who is board director at the Matriarch PAC. It's a new PAC aimed to increase the number of progressive working women in office. And Gustavo Arellano, feature writer for the Los Angeles Times, a frequent contributor on KCRW. Hi, you guys. Welcome back.
Hola.
Okay, it is impeachment season, appears to be. And so I want to ask you all how you think impeachment is factoring into the Democratic side of this presidential contest. And I'll begin with you.
Wow. Well, I would say that neither, it's not great for the Democrats or the Republicans. And part of that has to do with the other elephant in the room, which is Joe Biden's name popping up over and over during impeachment. So, you know, there's, I think if you watch the impeachments, which I assume nobody in this audience actually watched because it was like watching paint dry on a wall, that was intentional. The Republicans don't want the ratings, the Democrats don't want the ratings, but I think the Democrats ultimately want to get the vote. And the vote, you know, in the House, of course, you know, because the House is controlled by the Democrats, is going to be in favor of impeachment. Where the Senate goes, you know, most likely they're going to be the big question. You have senators from Utah who are critical of Trump. You know, I guess we have to see how this plays out legally as well. But ultimately, I think the Republicans are going to be focused on keeping the Senate, and what happens with the president happens with the president. From my guess with the Republican Party,
I think impeachment matters very little for the presidential race. My impression from seeing what political reporters say they're hearing on the trail, what candidates are asked about on the trail, it's just not coming up very much. It's not something that the presidential candidates are having to discuss very much. And then the impeachment polling moved a lot a few months ago when we got this brand new scandal around Ukraine. For there was a period a few months ago where it looked like, you know, there was an activist core in the Democratic Party that really wanted the president impeached, but the polling on impeachment was bad for Democrats and that looked hazardous. That's just completely changed. The basically the entire anti-Trump coalition, or nearly all of it, has coalesced around the idea that the president should be impeached. And so it's like one of many other things. It's like it's sort of like often there's just one poll question now that people listen to anything and you ask them about the NFL or anything like that. And really just people hear the question is, do you like Donald Trump or not? And so the impeachment question has sort of converged on that. So I don't think it's politically hazardous for Democrats to impeach even in competitive districts. And I also think it will sort of feel like ancient history by the time the election comes around. The Senate trial should be done by probably sometime in February. So it'll be 9 months on when we have the election. And then the question, you know, if you vote Trump out of office, the question of whether he should be impeached essentially has been mooted because you have voted him out. So I don't think that it's very important either way for how Democrats either will choose a nominee or how that nominee will perform in the November election.
It's anticlimactic. The whole question that the United States had for the past year, will the Democrats try to do impeachment? And it seemed like it wasn't going to happen after Mueller. Then Ukraine pops up. Now it's happening. And we know how it's going to end. The Democrats are going to impeach him in the House. The Senate's going to absolve him. End of story. We're done in February. Off to the races. Trump's not going to win any more voters off of this because he's been crying witch hunt all this time. All the time the people that he's been saying that, the people are going to be with him. The Democrats, I'll say this with the Democrats, at least the ones who really wanted Trump out of office, they say, okay, now, thank you, Pelosi. Like, we believe that you're going to be with us against Trump. So if anything, I think the Democrats get emboldened more than the Republicans win from this.
I just have, you know, one big question here. If the way that Donald Trump is reacting is as if he's in crisis, the way his staff is reacting is as if he's in crisis, is there going to be a moment, I no presidential historians on the panel as far as I know, where he could actually have to step down? And would that be good for Democrats or Republicans?
I mean, I think that when you look at the impeachment polling numbers during the Nixon administration, you know, Nixon left office with a 25% approval rating. So he kept half his base all the way through. And even a few months out, he had much higher numbers than that. So I think the political effects are the same, which is that the Republican Party will abandon the president if there gets to a point where it's more damaging to the party to keep him than to toss him.
But that would have the poll numbers. 95%, right?
He likes to say 95. It's probably closer to 90. But yeah, partly that's, you know, party ID is not quite the same thing as race or various other, like, people will sometimes, part of what's happened with Trump is that people who used to say they were Republicans now just told pollsters that they're not Republicans. So partly the loss of support among Republicans that's happened with the president is not showing up as Republicans saying they don't like him. It's showing up as people saying they're not Republicans anymore. But yeah, no, the broadly it's correct. He is holding on to a large enough political base. And if Republicans betray him in the Senate and remove him, he will make their life hell as they try to elect Mike Pence or whoever else. So the president's numbers would have to be a lot worse than they are right now for Republicans to look at this and say, we're better off going through the civil war in our party and removing him than sticking by him. So I think I also think removal is very unlikely, regardless of the merits, unless something happened to shift the polls. But the polling numbers have been weirdly stable over the last 3 years. The president's approval numbers don't move around that much. And maybe that's actually not that weird, because, like, why would your opinion on Donald Trump change? Like,
he was elected.
We knew who he was, and people formed their views, and they basically stayed the same.
But what is all this doing to the so-called independent voter? And I know you say, and you're right, that people say they're independent, but they actually vote with one party or another. But there are people who are the so-called Obama voters who went for Trump, like people who are persuadable along that line. What does this do to them? And those voters are especially attractive in these kind of Rust Belt states that the Democrats need to win.
I think at that point, it just boils down to policy. All Trump has now, great stock numbers, and Democrats are evil, witch hunt. That's where it depends for the Democrats to then say, look, we have policies. Like, you were with Obama at one era, then you were with Trump because you didn't believe that there was going to be change, but we have actual change, whether it's Medicare for all, whether it's the Green New Deal or whatever. So I think the Democrats, whoever the candidate's going to be, has to have some sort of policy that's going to speak to those Rust Belt voters and whatnot.
And one thing to keep in mind that hasn't been highlighted enough is that turnout was lower in some of those states. It's not so much that they flipped, and they did flip. There were many voters who did flip, but there was also a large chunk that stayed home. And so that, I think, is why the progressive base, this is exciting to see this kind of this energetic base, you know, even whether younger or older, they're likely to turn out. I mean, how many of those Rust Belt voters turned out for Bernie Sanders and voted, you know, in more open primaries for Bernie Sanders and then voted for Trump or just stayed home?
I just go back to those New York Times polls in the battleground states, and they found about 15% of the people who responded said that they might vote for either side, but really only 9% of the respondents actually made different choices when you gave them, you know, they said they would vote for Biden, but they'd vote for Trump over Warren, or vice versa, but vice versa was a lot less common. And it broke down into a few groups. You had the affluent voters who think that Warren is too far to the left. You had non-college white voters, many of whom agree with statements like, I think political correctness has gone too far, or I think a lot of women candidates are just not likable. So that's, you know, there could be sexism at work there. There can be sort of broad cultural factors that are often not even really about public policy. I like to think of like the president saying, I'm going to let people say Merry Christmas again. Like, of course, you can say Merry Christmas. That's not policy, but it reflects an idea that people have about the culture and they vote on it. And then it's some of these non-white voters. 2/3 of the persuadable non-white group is men. And it's, you know, who have much less unfavorable views on Trump than people in the broader non-white demographic groups do. And also, to some extent, you're looking there in that persuadable group. You have a lot of voters who say they approve of the president's performance on the economy, even though they don't like him, they don't approve of his broad performance. So that could be a cross pressure that people are dealing with. They basically feel materially satisfied with what Donald Trump has done, but they don't like him very much. And I think that's, to Gustavo's point, that's going to depend a lot on the specific pitch from the Democratic candidate.
Okay. Yeah. Final question. I'm going to put you all on the record. Who's going to be the Democratic Party nominee?
Oh, man.
No pressure. Gustavo.
I think Warren after all of that, because again, it all goes to the young voters. If they're going to come out, they're going to want to go with someone who's more radical than moderate. So Buttigieg and Biden, I don't think do it, but I think Warren will. That said, I don't know if Warren can beat Trump.
Namaki.
If we don't go to a brokered convention, I believe it'll be Bernie Sanders still, because he's not polled accurately. And if it does go to a brokered convention, I have no idea. Deval Patrick?
No,
I'm just kidding.
I think it's going to be Joe Biden. And I think it's crazy that nobody says they think it's going to be Joe Biden, who leads the polls almost all of the time. Like, it's not definitely going to be Joe Biden. And, like, I can see paths for a lot of these candidates. But I feel like, you know, it's been, like, the erasure of Joe Biden. The front runner. People are acting like the front runner in this campaign doesn't exist, which I just find completely bizarre.
Sleeping giant.
That's it. Okay. That is it for a special edition of KCRW's Press Play from the Democratic Party State Convention. Thank you to Gustavo Arellano, features writer for the Los Angeles Times and frequent contributor to KCRW, Josh Barrow, business columnist at New York Magazine and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center, and Namaki Konst, board director at Matriarch PAC. And thanks to Ben Christopher, politics reporter for Cal Matters. Special thanks to Julia Wang and Intertrend for hosting us at the Edison Theater here in Long Beach. Michelle Aloy and Sarah Sweeney produced today's show. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. Stephen Colon engineered our live broadcast. Thanks to our events team, Melanie Makaivi, Olivia Surnow, and Jason Groman. Thank you all for being here. I'm Madeline Brand.